Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.
Joining us today is Jason Gorman. Jason is a software development practitioner, trainer, coach, and author based in London with 25 years experience working with teams in a wide range of industries.
Welcome, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get started, would you just kind of give a little history of yourself and maybe tell us how you got started in the industry?
Oh, okay. Well, how far back do you want me to go? First, the dinosaurs came, and then very shortly after that, I started programming. So I sort of picked up programming as a hobby as a child when computers first started coming into the home. In the UK, we had the ZX81 from Sinclair and the Acorn computer, the BBC Micro, as it became more popularly known. So I programmed for a hobby for quite a few years, and then studied physics at university, and there was a fair amount of programming involved in that. But I kind of fell into a career as a programmer. I'd never intended to do it, but after I left with a really bad degree in physics, realized that a career as a physicist was probably not on the cards, and sort of said, well, to myself, well, I can do this programming lark, so I'll do that for a while. And this was sort of around the mid 90s, and I was lucky enough to get a job with a software company who employed far more experienced software engineers than me. At the time, I mean, I've been programming for, I don't know, 12, 13 years, and I really thought I was the bee's knees. it wasn't until I worked with people who knew about things like requirements and testing and version control, and I'd never worked on a team before, really. And so I had a kind of a 2-year apprenticeship, really, being mentored by these much more experienced developers. And that really, I really got the bug for it. Then I really realized that I really enjoyed this. This is like a proper job, not just a stopgap. And so I started contracting, freelancing in London mostly, and have found more and more that I was mentoring and then training developers. And over the last decade or so, that's pretty much all I do now. So it's been a progression. And there were some, you know, interesting diversions along the way. I spent the late 90s wearing the big pointy hat of an architect and doing the UML thing. You know, and preaching the gospel of Rumbaugh, Booch, and Jacobson, and all of that. But I really got bitten by the agile bug, sort of. But when Kent Beck and others were doing the rounds in the late 90s, talking about extreme programming and test-driven development, that really resonated with me.
Yeah, and you quite literally wrote the book on test-driven development, or at least a book on test-driven development.
I wrote a book on test-driven development. It's not quite the same. There's a course book that comes with the TDD course I do. But I, you know, I've read Kent's book and many others, and so there are a lot of really great books out there that heavily influenced me. And my book is really just a summary of those books and other great books like Clean Code and Goyko Adjic's book on bridging the communication gap, and other great stuff about TDD and specification by example and design principles and refactoring and the whole sort of code craft. So I summarize it in 200 pages.
So what are you doing these days?
Well, mostly training and coaching developers. So I have a company called Codemanship, a very little company. And I travel around and about the countryside and do courses on TDD and unit testing and refactoring and design principles. You know, all the stuff basically that the agile crowd are basically, you know, essentially not focusing on. So I don't teach Scrum or Lean or Kanban or any of that. I'm very much the sort of code facing stuff.
Not too long ago, you tweeted out, "It's a classic TDD mistake to start by thinking I need a foo class and then writing foo foo equals new foo."
Yes.
You and I kind of traded thoughts via Twitter on that. Do you want to maybe go a little bit more into depth on that? What did he mean by that?
I don't know. I suppose from a testing perspective, and from a design perspective, it's a bit of a tautology, isn't it? So if you've ever written a test that sort of, if you stopped and thought, I need a customer class, so I'll write a test that creates a customer class, and then I'll assert that it's not null when I've created that instance. It's kind of a tautology, because the next test you write that asks the customer class to do something, that test is going to fail if there's no customer class. And I kind of feel like it's putting the cart before the horse, in the sense that this is my own personal preference, really. So you know, there are lots of different ways of doing it, but I kind of feel comfortable writing tests that are about interesting behavior and let the design details fall out of that. I get a bit uncomfortable. Maybe it's the Asperger's in me, but I get a bit uncomfortable when people write tests that are about a design that they want to do, rather than coming up with a design to pass the test that they want to write. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just a personal thing of mine that it, and particularly because I'm often asked by clients to do technical interviews. So I'll pair program with people, and that's one of the very common things that people do, is they go, right, this is the design that I want. So these are the tests that I'm going to write. And I kind of feel it should be the other way around, that this is the test that it needs to pass. Therefore, this is the simplest design that will do that.
I've had the opportunity to introduce TDD and just the concept of unit testing in general to a number of different clients, a number of different small teams. What has been your experience in bridging that gap and making those introductions to those that might not have practiced unit testing or test-driven development?
Many and varied. I think people are coming at it from lots of different directions. I mean, the best I can do is really show people what I would do in a kind of, I suppose, in a kind of idealized environment. So the course that I teach doesn't have any slides, for example. There's no real taught material. I generally just demonstrate that this is, let's do. So we start by doing a Fibonacci calculator, which is kind of a very simple little toy example. And I demonstrate how I would triangulate that. But I'm very much, you know, let people sort of make their own minds up and make their own mistakes, just like I had to, because I don't want to rob them of an opportunity to figure stuff out for themselves. Having said that, there are certain things that I do tell them, look, hey, you know, have you tried, you know, starting with the assertion and working backwards? Have you tried running the test to make sure that it does fail when the result is wrong and stuff? Stuff that I'm trying to encourage them to get into the habit of. But outside of that, there's a lot of personal exploration. So I tend to be quite hands off and let people explore.
So when you're teaching your class and you've got individuals who have never done TDD before, mm-hmm. and they hit that mental block where they can't wrap their head around the fact that the test is just some more code that's, you know, is just running. Mm. How do you coach them through that without starting with okay, well, what's the next step you want to do? Okay, write the test that'll make you do that step.
A lot of this comes with practice, I think. I generally demonstrate. So if I need to sort of illustrate a point, I will show them somehow what I mean. So I haven't really run very often into that stumbling block of people. There's an element of TDD that I think is a bit of a leap of faith for people, and try as I might, I think if, you know, I'm not under the illusion. I don't really think of myself as a teacher. I don't think that's necessarily my strength. I think other people are much better at that than I am. But what I try to do with the courses and with coaching is to try and create an environment where people have an opportunity to learn and to figure stuff out for themselves. With the best will in the world, some people are going to walk away having not really got it. Yeah. In a room with 20 people in it, there's a limit to how much time I can dedicate to getting through that. But I'm normally working with a very self-selecting audience, so they've already normally sold it to themselves before they come into the room. So that makes my job a little easier in the sense I'm not trying to sell them the benefits of TDD. They've already decided, and that's kind of why they're there. So they tend to approach it. I'm very lucky. I tend to find myself with developers who come at it with a lot of enthusiasm and quite an open mind. And occasionally you get someone that's skeptical, but you know, if people don't want to learn it, they won't.
I've worked on a number of different small teams with varying levels of enthusiasm for test-driven development, all the way from, I don't want to do it, don't make me do it, through, yeah, this seems like an ideal way to develop software.
Mm.
Those that are really just against it from the start, it's almost not worth the effort to go through it. If they want to adopt it, great. They're going to have to come to it on their own at that point.
I completely agree. I really encourage clients not to try and force this onto people. It's unfortunate sometimes. There are, I have worked in situations where the CTO or someone has said, you know, thou shalt all do TDD, and it's not gone down very well. And it's a very, very difficult situation for a coach. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it right the tests first.
One such team I introduced TDD to, I came on as a consultant for a consultant firm and had mentioned that I had been doing test-driven development and wondered if the team would be interested. And they said, absolutely, we should do, we're getting together for a week-long department get-together, go over some training and skills building and things like that. So put something together, we'll spend a couple of days on it. Then it became, okay, maybe we'll spend one day on it. Then it became, all right, you have 3 hours, you have 1 hour to expose the team to this. Further on in that conversation, it came to light that they used to put unit tests and testing on their proposals to their clients and allow it to be a line item that could be vetoed and was often vetoed because the client didn't want to pay for that. They didn't want to pay for testing.
Yeah, so I see that quite a lot, actually. It's the same with any of these sort of technical practices, like refactoring is another good example. I think Robert Martin recently was tweeting about, you know, don't make refactoring a line item. And I wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment that's a conversation you should never have with a customer or with a non-technical stakeholder, because you're inviting them to say no.
So I kind of have some experience working as an aerospace engineer, and that's actually how I started. And it's a really odd thing to me, you know, coming from that field. I mean, I'm not saying that everyone was completely serious, but there was certainly a gravity and weight, and no one was going to get on you if you said, oh, wait, here's my result, but I need to go second check. I need to, you know, before we actually take this, you know, I need to go double check my work and make sure that it's right. No one's going to go, oh, why are you doing extra work here? Are we paying for that? Because the weight of making a mistake means probably that people die, they may get injured, bad things happen, right? Like there's a weight to that decision. And it just is sort of odd to me that to come into this field and to see such a lack of that weight and to see so many different people sort of being willing to sort of say, yeah, it's just code, you know, we can survive it. And now, you know, the code development is everywhere. And certainly it may not be, I mean, it might be flying the planes, but, you know, maybe that's not what you're working on. But most of the people that we're, you know, talking to and, the you know, most of the work that I, you know, I've done here in the field, you're holding a whole company, you're holding the productivity of a company, you're holding pieces that are actually driving the success of that company in your hands while you're busy working on that code. And you know, making mistakes in it can certainly have some pretty serious ramifications. And maybe, I don't know, I don't know if like the industry needs to mature or what, but it sort of is still shocking that there still is so much repulsion to just simply double checking your work.
Yes, I have this conversation more and more often now with developers working with clients I'm getting quite old now. I'm sort of heading rapidly towards 50, and one of the things that constantly surprises me is the price of a pint of beer. I can never get used to it. It's about averages at about, you know, £5 in London, and those kind of things always catch me. In the same way that the power of computers always catch me, I still haven't quite got over having more than 4K of RAM. So I'm still really tight when it comes to spending RAM when I really don't need to be. And I think one of the things that catches up with us faster than we know probably is the extent to which everybody's kind of relying on this software. And maybe we don't know our own strength when I speak to developers at Facebook and at Google who will say, well, at the end of the day, Jace, what we're doing, it's not as if it's safety critical. I'm like, well, you've got 1.5 billion users. So it may be 99.999% reliable, but if you've got 1.5 billion users, that's not good enough. And that you're still talking about hundreds of thousands of people potentially being caught out. And there are all sorts of really quite upsetting stories about, you know, very fairly innocuous pieces of software actually ruining people's lives. I think there was a story recently about a very tragic story about a transgender teacher that was accidentally outed by a social network to people that did not know she was transgender. And she ended up taking her own life. I read today that the same social network apparently is asking for people's bank balances. So when you're holding that kind of personal information in people's hands, it's stuff that doesn't. Yes, it's not you know, operating the brakes on a car or operating the wings of a plane. But you can ruin people's lives. You can ruin, as you said, you can ruin people's businesses. And I keep trying to make people more and more aware of the fact of the load that some of their code is carrying. And I think it's particularly true of frameworks and libraries that people write these things. I think there's a portion of most people's code that's probably more critical than they think it is.
So unit tests can be both assets and liabilities. How do you determine the ROI for them?
The short answer is I don't. It's very difficult. I'm kind of always a bit wary of that term, return on investment, because I've seen it abused so often in technology sales. But I think there's a balance that needs to be struck between the amount of unit testing you do, the amount of test code that you write and have to support, and the benefits that you get from it. And I think one of the best clues for that is, are you familiar with I think it's a web page now, but it's an article by Steve McConnell who wrote Code Complete called Software Quality at Top Speed. So I don't have the link to hand. We can dig it out later. But there's a graph which is based on a fairly sizable portion of decent data measuring the relationship between the quality of software as it ships and the amount of effort that was put into creating that software. And to a point, counterintuitively, I think for a lot of managers in particular, to a point, the higher the quality of the code that ships, the lower the bug count, the lower the cost of shipping it. And I think that there is a sweet spot there where if you take more care, if you do more tests and et cetera, you tend to go faster, which a lot of people, I think, tend not to, are very skeptical of. Because I think the received wisdom is that if code's more reliable, we must have taken longer to deliver it. We must have taken more time. But I think there's a misunderstanding about the relationship between quality and productivity that's been damaging our industry for decades now. So I would say about 99% of teams are on the left-hand side of McConnell's curve there, in the sense that if they took more care, if they tested more, for example, and tested earlier and more often, they would go faster. And we understand the causal mechanisms for that in terms of the rising cost of fixing bugs the longer they go undiscovered and et cetera. So there's all that side of it. And I suppose you could be quite scientific about it, quite objective, and go, look, you know, we do more and see whether or not we take longer, whether or not we go faster. The flip side of that is that if you're automating tests, you're creating more code, and that code has to be maintained and it has to be supported like any other code. If your test code is difficult to change, then your code is difficult to change. I've not been able to really study this because there is not a lot of data out there about the relationship between unit test code and overall cost. Unfortunately, it's not something anyone seems to be studying, and I don't have enough data points. I only have my own personal subjective anecdotal experience of, you know, how that works. But I've seen teams do it really well. I've seen teams who've literally had tests that have millions of test cases, but they've managed to do it with a relatively low amount of test code. And I think that maybe is the key to it. It's not just how much test code there is, but how easy is that test code to change? And when I see teams who get into difficulties because their test code becomes very difficult to change and difficult to work with, there's usually some underlying cause, like they didn't really refactor the test code. There's a very pernicious idea going around that you don't remove duplication from test code, which is obvious nonsense. There are ways of removing duplication from code that still leave it easy to understand. So I don't see wide enough use of parameterized tests, for example. A lot of teams, I don't see them using them at all. So they'll reproduce, they'll have like 50 examples of the same thing as separate tests.
Yeah. And I think it's important to be deliberate and pragmatic about what you're choosing to test and how you're choosing to test it. I see teams get into trouble by ensuring that they're testing every line of every function explicitly, as essentially rewriting the function in test, as opposed to trying to test the behavior that they're interested in. Because if you're testing line by line, it's going to be very difficult when the business rule changes or when a new enhancement needs to come through, or where you just need to do some refactoring, because then it's going to be very difficult to unwind your test suite at that point.
I totally agree. I think there's not enough is really talked about the sort of the design and the architecture and the approach to test code. There are a few people, I mean, Steve Freeman and Nat Price, I know, have talked about this quite a lot, about listening to your tests. But that's a whole subject in its own right. And there's a couple of good books about it. The unit, the X unit patterns book, for example, is a great book. But on the whole, we haven't put a lot of thought into this. And there's also a lot of legacy thinking that comes with it, like the whole, you know, this idea that you don't remove the duplication from test code because someone said so, and, or someone read it in a book. I don't know, the lack of imagination that goes into the design of test code. And also, yeah, you've got to choose your battles carefully. You can test every. I've seen people get down. I had someone on a training course once, a lovely American chap who came over, and he was of the opinion that you test everything. You test constructors, you test getters and setters. And I think he was quite surprised, a bit shocked, when he saw how relatively few tests I actually write. I get exactly the same coverage. It's 100% because I don't write any source code unless there's a test that requires it. But yeah, I tend to write tests for interesting behavior. I'm not thinking coverage.
So this is kind of, again, getting back to the beginning, or one of the things we kind of mentioned in the beginning, but I'm a person who particularly likes the it exists, and of course it doesn't live long, but it is always sort of my, and maybe it's just a crutch, but it's sort of the first step that I always take, and what tends to be, so since you're sort of, and I totally understand where you're coming from, the idea of, That's sort of where the rest of the code kind of comes, the tests come from, is looking at the behavior. What, you know, that's ultimately what I want to be testing, and not testing the design that you have in mind. But what tends to be the first test, or how do you begin that approach?
Well, I follow Kent Beck's advice on triangulating. I will often sit down if I'm given a new requirement or a new problem to solve or a new exercise, I will often sit down and quickly sort of make a list of the test cases that I think I need to cover, and just come up with some examples. And typically I will start with the simplest example I can think of.
Okay.
The one that I can say, well, like, that would be easy to pass. You know, you just return a hard-coded string, or you just return zero and that will pass it. So I tend to start with what's the simplest example of this particular behavior that I can think of.
So I will, if you're test driving, you know, square root algorithm, you might start by going, well, what's the simplest square root I can think of? And the answer might be, well, what's the square root of zero? What's the simplest question I can ask to get me started? But like, if you're, you know, test driving something that sorts, you know, customer names, you might start with, well, how would it sort an empty array? How would it sort an array of one? Etc. etc. So you can kind of start really simple and then gradually get more ambitious.
Okay. I guess, yeah, that's sort of my second test, I guess. And maybe I just should just go to that test as the first one because the it exists just ends up getting written and then deleted.
Yeah. There are lots of different approaches. That's one of the great things about software development, is there are no hard and fast rules about it. I find that the way I, this is such a such a cop out. It works for me, and I think what's important for me as a trainer is I can, in the same way that you can kind of explain the way that you do it and the rationale for that, I do think it's important that when people ask, you have a realistic answer as to why they've done this because, and so I tend to say to people, look, come up with the simplest example you can think of, make as few design decisions as you can get away with.
Perfect. Perfect.
And try and try to sort of edge your way along, making as, you know, one or two design decisions at a time.
Awesome. Well, thank you. One of the things we always ask our guests are to basically give a little bit of advice that they might have to share with anyone who's sort of new in the industry or just trying to get into the industry. And so do you have any advice that you might be able to share with them?
Oh, I'm try and think back now to the mists of time. One of the ways that I got really lucky when I first started in this career was that I just happened, like I didn't seek it out, didn't even know what it was, couldn't have sought it out. But I happened to fall in with, a company that employed a lot of really senior, I mean, very experienced, like 30 plus years, as software engineers. And I found that experience, I progressed so fast, so quickly, just having people pointing out books that I might want to look at, or, you know, websites that I might want to have a look at or whatever, and that things I'd never heard of before and would never have thought to go looking for. So I think if you're just starting out, if you can find someone that has a lot more experience and learn from them, I think that is something that's really, really important. It's very difficult because we have a tendency in our industry to promote people away from the code face. I think the average level of experience of a software developer is less than 5 years. So these people are hard to find, I understand that. But if you can seek them out and get over the fact that the book they're recommending is more than 10 years old, there might still be some ancient wisdom in there somewhere that would benefit. Yeah, of course, if it's Delphi 2, it might have lost its usefulness. I miss Delphi. If it's, you know, lots of books of techniques that I had no idea that people programmed computers before the 1980s, really. I mean, I kind of knew. I'd seen them on the telly, in films, but, you know, never really occurred to me that people had been talking about things like unit testing and requirements engineering, all those wonderful things, long before I was born. I mean, TDD, I think, was dates from the 1950s. So there is a lot of old wisdom out there, and if you could seek out some of those old wise people and put up with their gruffness and their get off my lawn attitude, I suppose I include myself in that, and see what you can learn from them. They won't always be right, but they will have done stuff, you know, they will have done stuff that you might not have heard of, and it saved you so much time. It really will. Saved me so much time. It was the making of me as a developer. I don't think I would have carried on in this job if I hadn't had that experience.
Well, thank you. That sounds like some excellent advice. Along those same lines, you started kind of bringing it up, but do you have any resources or what for people trying to get into TDD? I mean, you obviously have mentioned your book and you know, what would you recommend there?
I highly recommend Kent Beck's book, Test Driven Development by Example. As a good starting point, a book that I think is a good lead on from that, once you sort of got the hang of the basics of red green refactoring and triangulation and that kind of emergent style of design that Ken explained so well, is the Goose book, Growing Object Oriented Software Guided by Tests, by Steve Freeman and Nat Price. And Stephen Nat, I know they're London based. It's a great book, and it works through a whole example all the way through, so it's not sort of toy examples like I do. If you want to read my book, you can actually, he shamelessly plugged, you can download it for free. So if you go to the Codemanship website, you'll find that it's available in glorious color as a PDF, absolutely free, 222 pages. It was 200 pages, but then Word did something to the formatting. And so now it's 222 pages. Never mind the quality, feel the width. So I think my book is like it was designed as a spine. If you read the list of suggested reading at the back, it's designed as a spine to lead off to all these great books like Refactoring by Martin Fowler and the TDD book by Kent Beck. And that was that's something I really wish I'd had when I was much younger. You know, it's just a book that goes, okay, here's a spine of something that talks about specification by example and customer tests and continuous integration and continuous delivery and parameterized testing and property-based testing and all those things, but not in massive, massive detail, but in a practical way. So there's lots of good examples and exercises you can take from the book as well.
Awesome. Well, and then lastly, where might people follow you? We've obviously mentioned Twitter.
So I'm just Jason Gorman on Twitter. What's my company name again? Oh yeah, Codemanship as well on Twitter. So that's purely company stuff. If you follow me personally on Twitter, I should warn you, I'm quite strident with my liberal, left leaning, old socialist politics. I apologize for that in advance. That it's these days mostly about Brexit, but then most tweets these days are about Brexit. But the occasional tidbit or rant or whatever about technology. Most of the sort of technology stuff goes through the Codemanship web account. Codemanship.com is the website. There's a bunch of free resources on there and links to the YouTube channel with screencasts and other stuff.
All right, great. Thanks so much, Jason.
No, thank you.
That was Jason Gorman. Jason is a software development practitioner, trainer, coach, and author based in London with 25 years experience working with teams in a wide range of industries.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.